Hello and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, March 20th, 2024. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. First on our list today is a headline from the first page, Clear Creek Restoration Underway in Coralville. $4.1 million project to be funded with sale of stream mitigation credits by Alejandro Rojas. The City of Coralville is launching a $4.1 million project to restore Clear Creek to its natural state, improve its water quality, and add recreational elements. The project came about during creation of a master plan to improve the water quality of the Iowa River, which Clear Creek flows into, according to Coralville Parks and Recreation Director Sherry Proud. We started looking at the Clear Creek Trail or the Clear Creek Stream, and we own almost the majority of the land beside it, from Interstate 380 all the way to Highway 6, she said. So it was an easier discussion about how we could get started and improvements you can make there. Proud said the idea for the project came from Judy Joyce, Director of Community Building at Impact 7G, a Johnston-based consulting firm that focuses on environmental projects and helped design the Clear Creek project. Joyce said she did wetland mitigation work in the late 1990s and the 2000s in Coralville and was thinking even then of ways to improve Clear Creek. It's always been in the back of my mind that it would be great to have enough money to modify and restore Clear Creek so that it could not only improve water quality, flooding, fish habitat, but also provide a recreational component so that people could get on the creek, they could stomp around, they could float it and kayak and basically make this into a water trail, Joyce said. The stream, which was straightened over the years to make room for infrastructure and agriculture, would be lengthened. Oxbows and bends would be added, creating flood storage and improving water quality, Joyce said. Down trees would be removed, with native trees planted to stabilize the stream's banks. Trails, signage, and access points for canoes and kayaks will be added. Coralville City Administrator Kelly Hayworth said the city thought residents would be interested in following the project's progress. Because the creek is hard to access, the city will install cameras along the creek so people can watch the work. We just thought this would be a good way for people to be able to follow along and see what's actually going on there, Hayworth said. It also helps us, you know, that we can monitor ourselves on a daily basis. The live stream can be accessed from the city's website. When the project is complete, the city plans to create a time-lapse video of the project. It's very important to me that we have these natural areas where people live so they can go out and have the same connection that I had when I was a kid, Joyce said. The creek project, estimated to cost $4.1 million, will be funded using stream mitigation credits from the Army Corps of Engineers. Coralville is acting as the bank for the credits. The city negotiates with regulatory agencies, mainly the Army Corps of Engineers and the Environmental Protection Agency, to create a restoration plan which determines how many credits the project will create. The Coralville project will generate 75,231 stream mitigation credits, which are sold to entities that need a construction permit, serving as an alternative to the permits. Mitigation credits are effectively one party doing something that provides a benefit to the environment, and those are then sold to another party who requires a permit, Matt Zare, chief of the Regulatory Division for the Army Corps of Engineers Rock Island Division, wrote in an email to the Gazette. The credits, he said, are a form of currency. Once a stream plan is approved by the Army Corps of Engineers, the credits are sold on the open market. Proud said using credits was a win-win for Coralville because it allowed the city to fund the Clear Creek project and do something good for the environment. Joyce said a similar credit system has existed for years for wetland marshes. The stream mitigation credits, she said, were created in 2017 by the Iowa Department of Natural Resources and the Army Corps of Engineers to restore streams. So if you impacted a stream, you have negative credits, and if you restore it, you have positive credits, Joyce said. With this new assessment in place, that opened up the potential to do what's called a mitigation bank. Joyce said credits for the project will be released in batches, with 11,284.65 sold for the first phase. The Iowa Department of Transportation bought over 9,700 credits from that first batch, and Coralville bought the remainder. Proud said the first batch of credits raised $1,128,465 for the project, with Coralville paying $157,720 for its credits. Credits will be released over the next few years, also in batches, providing a steady stream of income for the project. Proud said the money from these future sales will be used to complete future phases of the project and also maintain the creek. The first phase of the project, designed by Impact 7G and Bolton and Mank, is slated to finish in September. The plan is posted on the city's website. The work will mean the temporary closing of the Coralville Creekside Cross and Flow Trails, the Altmeyer Family Park and Disc Golf Course, and the Clear Creek Trail Creekside Ballpark. The I-380 underpass also will be closed, with the city creating a detour. Use of eminent domain for pipelines under fire. House Committee advances bill on 23-0 bipartisan vote by Tom Barton. House lawmakers and landowners impacted by proposed carbon dioxide pipelines continue to push Senate Republicans for restrictions on the ability for private companies to use eminent domain to build the projects. Eminent domain refers to the government's power to take private property for public benefit. House File 2522 advanced out of the House Ways and Means Committee on Tuesday on a 23-0 bipartisan vote. Representative Megan Jones, Republican of Sioux Rapids, abstained from voting as her family owns land that would be directly impacted by the pipelines. The bill would allow an applicant before the Iowa Utilities Board seeking eminent domain or landowners affected by an eminent domain proceeding to petition a court for a declaratory order to determine their rights and the constitutionality of the eminent domain request. The court would be able to determine, before the Iowa Utilities Board makes the final decision, whether the use of eminent domain to involuntarily take land is warranted by the proposed project. That decision could be appealed to higher courts. I think both entities deserve the right to know ahead of time if eminent domain is actually something that is applicable for that project, so that months, if not years, of stress, financial strain, lawyer fees, etc., are not wasted, if in the end a declaratory judgment for eminent domain is never going to happen, said Representative Bobby Kaufman, Republican of Wilton, chair of the House Ways and Means Committee. The House has passed bills the last two sessions limiting the scope of eminent domain for carbon capture pipeline projects, but they have not received hearings in the Senate. I think this is the bare minimum the state can do, and I think this is a good, fair piece of public policy for all things related to eminent domain, Kaufman said. A spokesman for Iowa Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer, Republican of Grimes, did not immediately respond to a message seeking comment on Tuesday. Two pipelines are proposed in Iowa that would deposit CO2 extracted from ethanol plants in the state to underground sequestration sites in Illinois and North Dakota. Summit Carbon Solutions has proposed a five-state pipeline that would cross about 690 miles of Iowa. The company has asked for eminent domain authority along the route of the project, which is awaiting approval from the Iowa Utilities Board. Bruce Rastetter, a major Republican donor and backer of Governor Kim Reynolds, leads pipeline company Summit Carbon Solutions. Another company, Wolf Carbon Solutions, proposes building a smaller pipeline covering five eastern Iowa counties, including Linn County. The company said it does not intend to use eminent domain for its construction. The issue has split both the Republican and Democratic caucuses, as competing interests from agriculture, labor, landowners, and environmentalists have led to a wide range of positions on the issue. And the final item on today's front page, lawmakers okay bill allowing Iowa cops to arrest people in U.S. illegally. Illegal reentry bill on its way to the governor's desk by Caleb McCullough. Iowa law enforcement would be allowed to arrest and judges would be able to order the removal of an immigrant who enters the U.S. illegally under a bill House lawmakers sent to Governor Kim Reynolds on Tuesday. The bill creates a new crime of illegal reentry and allows the state to prosecute immigrants if they are found to be in the country illegally after being previously denied entry or deported. Iowa Republicans have proposed several immigration enforcement bills this year, but Senate File 2340 is the first to gain the approval of both chambers of the legislature. Republicans argue the measures are necessary to respond to record numbers of illegal border crossings and have accused President Joe Biden of abandoning his responsibility to secure the border. Also Tuesday, the U.S. Supreme Court allowed a similar law passed last year in Texas to take effect while a court challenge plays out. The Texas law allows state officials to arrest and deport immigrants who enter the country illegally. Immigration enforcement is generally the responsibility of the federal government, and opponents have argued states do not have the authority to take measures like those in the Texas law and Iowa bill. The bill passed the House 64-30 with mostly Republican support. Democratic Representatives Josh Turek of Council Bluffs and Keenan Judge of Waukee joined Republicans in support, while Republican Representative Bryant Losey of Bon Durant joined most Democrats in voting against it. The bill now is eligible to be signed into law by Reynolds, a Republican. A spokesperson for Reynolds did not immediately respond to a request for comment on whether she intends to sign the bill. The bill and others like it have been opposed by a coalition of immigrant activists during the lawmaking process. Manny Galvez, a board member of Eastern Iowa immigrant rights group Escucha Mi Voz, said in a statement Tuesday the group would attempt to block the bill through courts and other avenues. From Texas to Iowa, our message is no tengan miedo, have no fear, Galvez said. We will continue to fight this unconstitutional law during rulemaking, in the courts, and on the streets. We will continue to organize to stop deportations, protect refugee children, and keep families together. Under the bill, if a person is arrested for illegal reentry by Iowa law enforcement, they could be charged with a Class D or Class C felony, depending on the circumstances. A Class D felony carries a prison sentence of up to 5 years, a Class C felony up to 10 years. During court proceedings, a judge could issue an order requiring the person charged be returned to their country of origin. Law enforcement would not be able to arrest a person for violating the law while they are at a school, religious institution, healthcare facility, or a facility that provides exams for survivors of sexual assault. The bill also would create civil immunity for city and state employees and contractors who are sued for implementing the law. Ex-teammate of trans swimmer to speak at UI. Paula Scanlon's UI lecture, Men Do Not Belong in Women's Sports, by Vanessa Miller. Just days after a dozen-plus college athletes sued the NCAA for violating their Title IX rights by letting transgender swimmer Leah Thomas compete in the 2022 National Championships, conservative student group Young Americans for Freedom at the University of Iowa announced one of Thomas' former teammates will visit campus next week for a talk titled Men Do Not Belong in Women's Sports. Former University of Pennsylvania swimmer Paula Scanlon's lecture and Q&A on the UI campus will highlight the importance of protecting women's spaces, including sports, bathrooms, and prisons, according to a news release from the UI student organization. Scanlon will share how radical gender ideology is destroying women's sports, in addition to championing freedom and the challenges she has overcome to share this message. The 7 p.m. Monday lecture is planned at the Black Box Theater of the Iowa Memorial Union on the UI campus, where the same student group a year ago hosted conservative commentator Matt Walsh as part of his nationwide What is a Woman documentary tour, an event that sparked protests from transgender rights advocates. Scanlon starred in Walsh's documentary before testifying in July before the House Judiciary Committee about the dangers and due process violations of gender-affirming care for children. In her testimony, Scanlon said, "My teammates and I were forced to undress in the presence of Leah 18 times a week. Some girls opted to change in bathroom stalls and others used the family bathroom to avoid this," she said during her testimony. "When we tried to voice our concern to the athletic department, we were told that Leah swimming and being in our locker room was non-negotiable, and we were offered psychological services to attempt to re-educate us to become comfortable with the idea of undressing in front of a male." Thomas in 2022 became the first openly transgender athlete to win a Division I championship in any sport, according to the Associated Press, topping three Olympic medalists and taking the title. She started her University of Pennsylvania swimming career on the men's team, but began transitioning in May 2019 and by 2021 had met NCAA hormone therapy requirements to swim on the women's team. Around the time of her championship, the NCAA, U.S. Olympic and Paralympic Committee, and the International Olympic Committee issued new transgender participation policies, calling for sport-by-sport determination. Thomas had teammates voice both support and opposition for her participation. The lawsuit against the NCAA filed Thursday in U.S. District Court in Atlanta, where Thomas won her title in the 2022 championships at host Georgia Tech University, seeks to stop the association from using transgender eligibility policies that adversely impact female athletes in violation of Title IX. An NCAA statement responding to the lawsuit said the association and its members will continue to promote Title IX, make unprecedented investments in women's sports, and ensure fair competition in all NCAA championships, according to the Associated Press. Two injured in CR house fire, by Emily Anderson. Two people were injured Tuesday morning in a house fire in southwest Cedar Rapids. According to a news release from the Cedar Rapids Fire Department, firefighters were dispatched to the 1200 block of N Street Southwest at 10:07 a.m. for a report of a fire. Two men were inside the home when the fire started. Cedar Rapids police officers had removed one of the men from the home before firefighters arrived on the scene. The other man was found by firefighters who entered the building to search while extinguishing the fire. One of the men was taken to Mercy Medical Center, and the other was taken to Unity Point Health St. Luke's Hospital. The release did not indicate the severity of their injuries, but it said their ages are approximately 50 and 80 years old. Two police officers also underwent medical evaluations after the fire. IC Police Search for Missing 12-Year-Old Boy Was Last Seen Getting on School Bus by Emily Anderson. The Iowa City Police Department is seeking the public's help in locating a 12-year-old who has been missing for more than 2 weeks. Jalen Brown has not returned home since getting on the school bus the morning of Friday, March 1st, according to a news release from the police department. Brown is about 5'11" and weighs 125 pounds. He was last seen wearing a gray hoodie and black pants with white stripes and carrying a black backpack. The release states, anyone with information about Brown's whereabouts is asked to contact the Joint Emergency Communications Center at 319-356-6800. House bill would give more protections to police. It seeks to clarify role of campus officers handling protests by Caleb McCullough. Iowa police officers would have more protection from losing their certification and from investigations under a bill advanced by Iowa House lawmakers Tuesday. The bill builds on the Back the Blue law lawmakers passed in 2021. That law penalizes local governments that selectively enforce state or local laws and raise the penalties for illegal protesting and rioting. The law, which lawmakers passed in response to the large protests following the murder of George Floyd in 2020, prohibited cities, counties, and local law enforcement agencies from having policies that discouraged the enforcement of certain laws. The new bill, House Study Bill 738, was advanced unanimously by a 3-member House subcommittee Tuesday. It is eligible for a vote in the House Ways and Means Committee. Skylar Limkeman of Tiffin, an attorney for the Iowa Fraternal Order of Police, which supports the bill, said the 2021 law was initially inspired by issues on Iowa's college campuses, but university police were left out of the final bill. One of the issues that came up at that time was officers were being told that they could not enforce state, local, or federal laws, he said. The problem was targeting the situation that was going on our college campuses because of the unique environment that our law enforcement officers there have to enforce state and local laws. But lobbyists for the Iowa Board of Regents, which govern the three public universities, have doubts about the bill. Keith Saunders, a representative for the Board of Regents, said the campuses decided to pull officers back when protesters were spray painting university buildings in 2020 out of concern for the officers' safety. We believe the language requiring our sworn police officers on all three campuses to enforce the laws of Iowa is redundant, said Carol Ann Jensen, another Regents lobbyist. We believe we already do that and have the power to do that. The bill would narrow the situations in which Iowa Law Enforcement Academy can revoke an officer's certification and give the academy the discretion to privately discipline an officer for misconduct. Current law says that the state law enforcement academy must decertify an officer who is fired for serious misconduct, which is defined as improper or illegal actions in connection with the officer's duties. What is improper? That is very subjective, and frankly, folks have weaponized the processes to try to go after police officer certification, not only here in Iowa, but across the country, Limkeman said. The academy does have the option to revoke an officer's certification in some cases without the officer having committed an illegal act. The bill also would allow the academy to, in those cases, privately reprimand an officer or agency without a public revocation or suspension of certification. Brainy Carney, director of Iowa Law Enforcement Academy, said the rules would create additional cost and work for the academy and that giving the academy the authority to punish police agencies would go beyond its current charge. He also said the bill would make it harder for the academy to enforce its certification process, shifting more of the responsibility onto the local agencies. This bill specifically makes it harder to appropriately deal with bad actors in law enforcement, he said. The Academy Council is the entity that grants the certification. They grant a peace officer certification in the state of Iowa, and this bill puts a lot of responsibility, a lot of onus, on the individual law enforcement agencies. The bill also would alter how investigations into officer misconduct can be conducted by a law enforcement agency. Under the proposal, officers who are the subject of a complaint would have the right to receive a copy of the incident report and video or audio recordings related to the incident in question before being interviewed by internal investigators. Support for the provision was mixed among law enforcement at the hearing. Representatives for the Fraternal Order of Police said they supported the provision and likened it to an officer reviewing body camera footage before testifying in a similar criminal court case. Dennis McDaniel, the police chief in Johnston and president of the Iowa Police Chiefs Association, said that in some of the department's more serious investigations, such as an officer-involved shooting, conducting interviews before officers review footage can be important in determining the facts. We have to get into the legal balancing act of that officer making an independent statement, being involved in that, or other officers that were witness to that, and the potential for them to offer testimony that might be altered based on reviewing the report, reviewing the video, he said. CR man charged in Bagley slaying seeks to move trial, by Trish Mahan. A Cedar Rapids man accused of hiring two men to kill Chris Bagley in 2018 will ask a judge next month to move his trial to another county because of extensive pretrial publicity. Andrew Thomas Shaw, 34, who is charged with first-degree murder, solicitation to commit murder, and conspiracy to commit a forcible felony, argues in a motion that there has been highly publicized trials of Drew Blahnik, now known as Johnny Blahnik Church, who was convicted of second-degree murder in the fatal stabbing of Bagley and two others also convicted in his killing. The motion, filed by Johnson County Chief Public Defender Peter Persaud and Julia Zielinski, Assistant Public Defender, argues that previous media coverage and social media posts regarding Shaw are permeated with references of Shaw being a drug dealer. The social media activity and posts regarding those cases has created an extraordinary degree of knowledge saturation in the jury pool, according to the motion. The motion includes several examples of Facebook comments on articles posted on television station and Gazette websites. Most of them mention Shaw's federal conviction for drug trafficking and Shaw's alleged involvement in Bagley's death. To ensure that Mr. Shaw receives the impartial jury to which he is constitutionally entitled, his trial must be moved to a different media market, the motion stated. Bagley, 31, of Walker, disappeared December 13, 2018, and his body was found March 1, 2019, buried in a yard in southeast Cedar Rapids. First Assistant Linn County Attorney Monica Slaughter, in her resistance to move the trial out of Linn County, argues the media coverage in the case has not been inflammatory. It has been uniformly factual and largely devoid of inaccuracies, denunciations of the defendant, or overly emotional coverage. Slaughter also said Facebook posts and comments on social media aren't media coverage just because they are attached to traditional media articles. The prosecution also disagreed with the defense's argument that the actual media coverage has been pervasive. The defense also failed to cite, and the prosecution cannot find, any controlling Iowa law regarding change of venue motions that address social media comments and posts, according to the prosecution motion. However, other courts have recognized that social media posts and comments don't support moving a trial, the motion stated. Slaughter said jury selection and pretrial questionnaires are tools that can weed out potential prejudices of jurors, which makes Shaw's motion premature at this time. The appellate courts have said that jury selection should be trusted to expose any prejudice among jurors. Shaw was charged last October after he was released from his federal prison sentence for trafficking marijuana in Cedar Rapids. Shaw is accused of aiding and abetting Drew Wagner, 37, and Blahnik Church, 35, both convicted in Bagley's fatal stabbing, between October 1, 2018 and February 20, 2019, according to the complaint. He also is accused of hiring them to kill Bagley and paying them for the crime, the complaint stated. Shaw has pleaded not guilty and remains in jail on $2 million bail pending trial. Wagner, during the trial for Blahnik Church, testified how he and Blahnik Church carried out Bagley's killing on behalf of their mutual drug dealer, Shaw, as revenge because Bagley had robbed Shaw of money and drugs and beat him up. Wagner said Bagley had stolen between $23,000 and up to $200,000 from Shaw. He also said he'd overheard Shaw asking Blahnik Church if he would kill Bagley for some amount of money. He didn't hear the dollar amount. In December 2018, Wagner got into a fight with Bagley and threw him up against a wall and held him as Blahnik Church stabbed Bagley multiple times. Blahnik Church brought the body back to Wagner's house and buried it in the yard on Souter Avenue Southeast, Wagner testified. Bagley's body, buried under a pile of lumber and a canoe by Wagner's garage, 4069 Souter Avenue Southeast, was excavated from the frozen ground by law enforcement March 1, 2019. Blahnik Church is serving 57 years in prison for Bagley's killing and also is serving time for assaulting another inmate while he was in the Linn County Jail. Here are some items from today's Capitol Notebook legislative roundup. Bill would end periodic hotel inspections. Iowa Senate advances legislation to get rid of the requirement. A requirement for periodic state inspections of Iowa hotels would be eliminated under legislation that advanced in the Iowa Senate on Tuesday. Under the Republican proposed legislation, which is supported by the State Inspection Agency and the trade association that represents hotels, a requirement that the Iowa Department of Inspections and Appeals inspect each hotel in Iowa once every 2 years would be removed from state law. Senator Kerry Colker, Republican of Dyersville, said the law codifies what essentially is already current practice by the state, which prioritizes requested inspections over mandated inspections, and inspections at food preparation and service locations over hotels. Colker also put the onus on hotel companies to self-police. We need to have our hotels step up and take responsibility for their reputation, their bedbug problems, their own communities, Colker said during debate. Democrats raised concerns about a lack of required hotel inspections, which they said could give Iowa a black eye and hurt tourism and efforts to grow the state's population if out-of-state visitors stay in dirty hotels. I don't understand why we don't want to have inspectors, said Senator Bill Dotsler, Democrat of Waterloo. We want to make sure that Iowa's a welcoming place. We are inviting and we want people here. We are short people who live in Iowa and we want to sell Iowa as a great place to live, visit, and enjoy yourself. This bill just smacks against all that. Colker, who spent 22 years as executive director of the Eastern Iowa Tourism Association, said she would not be running a bill if she thought it would hurt Iowa's tourism industry. The bill, House File 2426, passed the Senate on a largely party-line vote, with all Democrats voting against it and most Republicans voting for it. One Republican, Senator Rocky DeWitt, Republican of Lawton, joined Democrats in voting against the bill. The bill previously passed the House, but since it was amended in the Senate, it must return to the House for final approval before being sent to Governor Kim Reynolds' desk. Legal protections for pesticides advance. Legislation that would add legal protections for pesticide manufacturers that adhere to certain labeling requirements narrowly passed a Senate committee. Under the proposal, which was introduced by Republicans and proposed by pesticide manufacturer Bayer, pesticide manufacturers could not be sued for failing to alert people of potential health risks if the product has a federally approved warning label. Bayer has faced lawsuits from people claiming it failed to warn consumers of the potential health risks of the company's glyphosate-based herbicide Roundup. Bayer has a plant in Muscatine that manufactures Roundup. The bill stipulates that the immunity would not apply to Chinese state-owned companies, singling out the massive agriculture and chemical company Syngenta. The EPA found glyphosate is not likely to be carcinogenic and has determined there are no risks of concern to human health, but a U.S. appeals court in 2022 vacated those findings for procedural reasons and required the agency to reconsider. The bill, Senate Study Bill 3188, narrowly passed the Senate Budget Committee 11-9. It now is eligible for consideration by the full Senate. Adding fake photos to harassment laws. Images or videos that have been altered or faked, including through use of artificial intelligence, in an attempt to show an individual engaged in a sex act, would be added to the state's harassment laws under legislation approved unanimously by the Iowa Senate. The proposal would make such violations an aggravated misdemeanor, which is punishable by up to 2 years in jail and a fine of between $855 and $8,540. The proposal, House File 2240, passed the Senate 49-0. It also previously earned unanimous approval in the Iowa House, but will need to go back there for final approval because it was amended in the Senate. State drops E15 lawsuit. Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd announced her office has dropped a lawsuit after the federal government last month approved the year-round sale of the E15 blend of ethanol. I should not have to sue President Joe Biden in the first place to get him to follow the law, but I'm glad that he finally did the right thing by permitting the sale of E15 gasoline during the summer months, Byrd said in a statement. The new federal rule, which takes effect in April 2025, will apply in Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, Missouri, Nebraska, Ohio, South Dakota, and Wisconsin, according to the Associated Press. Those states grow the bulk of the U.S. corn crop and are home to much of the nation's ethanol production. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, March 20th, 2024, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's turn to today's obituaries. Elaine M. Shaw, 77, of Springville, passed away Monday, March 18th at her home, surrounded by her family, after a courageous battle with cancer. Visitation will be held from 3 to 8 p.m. on Friday, March 22nd, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Marion. Visitation will continue 1 hour prior to massive Christian burial that will begin at 10 a.m. on Saturday, March 23rd at St. Isidore Catholic Church in Springville. Reverend Andrew Awatwe Mensa will be officiating. Burial will follow at 3 p.m. at St. Patrick's Catholic Cemetery in Colesburg. Elaine was born May 30, 1946, in Dyersville, the daughter of George C. and Alice E. Hager Gall. She graduated from St. Boniface High School in New Vienna in 1963. She married Leonard Hildebrand on June 12, 1965, at St. Francis Basilica, Dyersville. He passed away on September 10, 1980. On December 6, 1985, she married David Shaw at St. Patrick Catholic Church in Colesburg. Elaine took great pride in raising her family. She worked at Ertles and Dyersville, Tom Jank Law Offices, and Hy-Vee, retiring in 2014. Memorials in Elaine's memory may be directed to Divine Word Seminary, Hall Prine Cancer Center, Dennis and Donna Uldorf Hospice House of Mercy, or St. Isidore Catholic Church. Please share a memory of Elaine at murdochfuneralhome.com. Joyce Ross of Cedar Rapids. Joy passed away on March 1, 2024, at the age of 88. She was preceded in death by her husband Ron, son Trent, and two sisters, Doris and Betty. Joy worked at Orthopedic Surgeons in the dental office of Burkhoff, Waste, and Tyler. She enjoyed her family so much, always loved celebrations and holidays. She was a wonderful mom and grandmother. We loved her dearly. As per her request, the family will have a private gathering. Please send donations in Joy's memory to Cedar Valley Humane Society in Cedar Rapids. Robert Bob Gene Welch of Cedar Rapids, age 64, passed away March 17th. Visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Thursday, March 21st at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. A funeral service will be held at 11 a.m. Friday, March 22nd at Cedar Memorial Park Chapel of Memories. Interment will follow at Cedar Memorial Park Cemetery. Online condolences may be directed to the family at cedarmemorial.com. David A. Popelka, 93, of Cedar Rapids, passed away peacefully in his home Friday, March 15th. Visitation will be held from 4 p.m. until 7 p.m. Monday, March 25th at Radiant Church in Cedar Rapids. Celebration of Life services will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, March 26th at Radiant Church. Burial will be in Czech National Cemetery. David Allen Popelka was born June 3, 1930, in Cedar Rapids, the son of Harold and Ruth Ruska Popelka. He grew up on 21st Street Southeast, and his favorite playground was at the end of the street in Van Vechten Park, on the hills and valleys where the creek emptied into the Cedar River. He met his future wife, Marilyn Rose Sveck, in 1946 at Hoos Memorial Presbyterian Church. They initially became friends as members of the choir and youth group, and began to date when Marilyn invited him to rainbow dances. He graduated in 1948 from McKinley High School, where he was introduced to his love of metalworking. His career began in 1948 at Cedar Rapids Engineering, also known as Quickway Manufacturing, where he worked as a tool room machinist. In January 1951, Dave enlisted in the Army, serving as a machinist in a railroad shop battalion in Korea for 21 months. His relationship with Marilyn continued to grow, as hundreds of letters were exchanged during this time away. In February 1954, they were married on Valentine's Day. After his discharge in January of 1954, he worked as a model shop machinist at PAL Engineering. In 1957, he started working at Square D Company in Cedar Rapids as a tool and die mold maker. In 1967, he was asked by Kirkwood Community College to fill an opening as the machinist instructor, where he started his 25-year career of sharing his love of machinist work with hundreds of men and women, including his sons. He retired from Kirkwood in 1992. Memorials may be directed to Radiant Church. Online condolences may be expressed to the family at broschchapel.com. Harold Buzz Fleming, 74, of Martell, died Thursday, March 14th at the Veterans Health Center in Iowa City. The family will greet friends from 1 to 4 p.m. Saturday, March 23rd at the Getch Funeral Home in Anamosa. Military honors will be accorded by the United States Army and the Anamosa Veterans Honor Guard at the conclusion of visitation. Please visit GetchOnline.com to share your thoughts, memories, and condolences with Buzz's family. A celebration of life for Buzz will be held at a later date. Harold Eugene Fleming was born in Olin on December 5, 1949, the son of Ivan and Ruth Bider Fleming. He attended school in Olin and helped his parents on the family farm. He served his country in the United States Army, being stationed in Vietnam during the Vietnam War. On October 16, 1976, he was united in marriage to Deborah Knutson at the Anamosa Baptist Church. The couple made their home in Martell. He worked as a semi-driver for the ADM Corporation and had also worked as a dispatcher and in construction. Buzz, having grown up on the farm, had a special fondness for tractors. Over the years, he spent countless hours restoring a total of 55 farm tractors, and he was in the process of completing his 56th. Paul Johnson, 44, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Thursday, March 7th at Mercy Hospital in Cedar Rapids. A memorial service will be held at New City Church at a later date. Paul was born February 6, 1980, in Iowa, son to Sharon Johnson. Paul worked in food service as a manager at McDonald's and also worked at Burger King, Pizza Hut, and Popeyes for many years. He enjoyed watching the Iowa Hawkeyes and Dallas Cowboys. He loved spending time with his family, working, and drinking sun-kissed orange soda. Please share your support and memories with Paul's family on his tribute wall at stuartbaxter.com. Marie Catherine Hurt, age 89, of Cedar Rapids, passed away on Sunday, March 17th at Meadowview Memory Care in Cedar Rapids. She was born July 26, 1934 in Richland Township, Iowa, the daughter of Claire and Mary Opitz Kopp. Marie graduated from high school and worked as a bookkeeper and a receptionist. Then in 1967, she worked in the customer service division in the city water department for 18 years, and then became the office supervisor for the next 14 years. Marie spent numerous years volunteering at Mercy Hospital gift shop. She loved horses, especially her childhood pony, Tony, and the Budweiser Clydesdales. In 1995, Marie married Glenn Hurt. A rosary service for Marie will be held on Thursday, March 21st at 10 o'clock, with time for visitation following until 1 p.m., all at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home in Cedar Rapids. Interment will follow at Strawberry Point Cemetery in Strawberry Point. Any memorials given will be directed to St. Jude Children's Research Hospital by the family. Online condolences are welcome at cedarmemorial.com. David Eugene Clem of Iowa City passed away peacefully, surrounded by his family, on March 17th. This was the end of a remarkable and courageous journey to live life despite of a very rare disease, primary systemic amyloidosis. For 29 years, David was professor of arts, religion, and contemporary culture at the University of Iowa Department of Religion. Over the years, it was not unusual for David to be approached by former students who generally told him the same thing, that he was their favorite teacher and often that he had changed their life. He loved teaching and he was the recipient of the Marion L. Wheat Award for Faculty Excellence, the Certificate of Appreciation from the Provost and Dean of the College of Liberal Arts for significant contributions as Director of the Honors Program, the University of Iowa Hancher Finkbein Medallion presented to one family member each year for learning, leadership, and loyalty to the University of Iowa, and was elected as a faculty member of Omicron Delta Kappa Honorary Society by student and faculty members. To honor and celebrate such a special man, a gathering for family and friends will be held Monday, March 25th from 4 to 7 p.m. at Lensing Funeral and Cremation Service in Iowa City. A memorial mass will be Tuesday, March 26th at 10:30 a.m. at St. Thomas More Catholic Church in Coralville. A luncheon with a time to share memories will follow the service at the church. In lieu of flowers, memorial donations may be made to HACAP, Garchinola Buddhist Center in Iowa City, or St. Thomas More Catholic Church of Coralville. Online condolences may be sent to his family at lensingfuneral.com. Earl Dean Putz Kim, 90, of Huntsville, Arkansas, passed peacefully at home with family by his side on March 8, 2024. Earl was born on April 17, 1933, to Porter J. and Esther E. Schaefer Kim in Blairstown, Iowa. Putz was mechanically inclined and well known for his ability to repair and operate big equipment. A dedicated member of the fire and rescue team, he found fulfillment in lending a hand to those in need. Earl was very proud to serve his country in the U.S. Army as a transportation specialist and was a member of the American Legion. He also loved to tease and be a recipient of the same. Memorial services will be 10:30 a.m. Thursday, March 21st at Fayetteville National Cemetery with Kelly Lindsay officiating. Services are entrusted to Brashear's Funeral Home and Crematory of Huntsville. Mildred Shutterly, age 86, died peacefully at home in Norway Saturday, March 16th. A private visitation will be held at a later date. Memorials may be directed to the family. Kloster Funeral Home Marengo is assisting the family with arrangements. Mildred was born October 31, 1937, to Otto and Anna Dorman. She married Loyal Shutterly on February 14, 1960, and worked on the family farm the remainder of her life. Mildred enjoyed listening to country gospel music on Sunday mornings and seasonal music at Christmas time. She liked caring for the cats on the farm. In her final days, Mildred had shown herself to be a fighter instead of a quitter when faced with difficulties. Online condolences may be left at closerfuneralhome.com. Irene von Munster, 94, of Anamosa, died Sunday, March 17th, surrounded by her loving family. Funeral services will be held at 11 o'clock Wednesday morning, March 20th, at the Getch Funeral Home in Anamosa. Friends may call from 9 until service time at the funeral home. Interment will be in the Antioch Cemetery. Pastor Holly Nouse will officiate at the services. Thoughts, memories, and online condolences may be left at getchonline.com. Irene Louise Elena von Sprecken was born October 4, 1929, in Olin. She was the daughter of John and Anna Hintz von Sprecken. She graduated from Oxford Junction High School. Irene married Leo von Munster on April 24, 1949, in Cedar Rapids. The couple farmed north of Clarence until 1963, when they purchased their farm east of Anamosa. Irene was the prime example of a farmer's wife. She raised her five children with love and devotion with her husband, Leo. Irene was a member of the First Congregational Church, the Eastern Star, and the Antioch Circle. She enjoyed sewing, gardening, flowers, quilting, family gatherings, and time spent with friends. She and Leo loved to dance, travel, and play cards. Janice Dorothy Thorne, 85, longtime resident of Iowa City, passed away at Crestview Specialty Care on March 15th. A memorial service will be held at 10 a.m. on Wednesday, March 27th, at St. Mark's United Methodist Church. A reception will follow the service. A family committal service will be held at Memory Garden Cemetery. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed to St. Mark's United Methodist Church or the charity of your choice. Janice was born on September 4, 1938, in St. Joseph, Missouri, to Harvey and Dorothy Schindler Fankhauser. She was raised in St. Joseph, where she graduated from Central High School. Janice went on to earn a bachelor's degree from Northeast Missouri State University and master's degree from the University of Iowa. On August 16, 1957, Janice married William Bill Thorne in St. Joseph. The couple settled in Iowa City in 1967, and together they raised their three children while spending 64 memorable years of marriage before his passing in 2022. Janice was a dedicated teacher, working for Clear Creek Amana Schools for 27 years before retiring in 2000. She enjoyed travel, reading, singing in the church choir, and most of all spending time with her grandchildren. Online condolences may be sent to her family at lensingfuneral.com. Darlene M. Meeks, 92, formerly of Belle Plaine, passed away March 17th. Darlene was born December 18, 1931, to William and Ella Canner Mussel in rural Chelsea. She attended country school till 8th grade. On June 30, 1954, Darlene married Robert Meeks at Christ United Methodist Church in Belle Plaine. Together, they lived on a farm in rural Belle Plaine, where Darlene raised their five children. In 2014, Darlene moved into Belle Plaine before spending the last 4 years in Hiawatha. Together with Robert, she enjoyed meeting up with friends, dancing, and going out to eat. Darlene was a great cook and baker, specializing in kolaches and huskas. She loved providing for her family, making sure no one ever left her home empty-handed. Private family services will take place with burial at National Cemetery, Vining, Iowa. Memorials may be directed to the family. Online condolences can be sent to the family at newhousefuneralservice.com. Lois Rosine Thedens, 89 years old, of Raleigh, died Monday, January 22nd at her home surrounded by her family, following a 2-year battle with breast cancer. Public memorial services will be 2 o'clock p.m. Saturday, March 23rd, at the First Presbyterian Church in Raleigh, with lunch to follow. Visitation will be for an hour before services, Saturday, March 23rd, at the church. Private family burial will be at a later date in the Raleigh Cemetery. Lois was born March 23rd in Russellville, Missouri, March 23rd, 1934, in Russellville, Missouri, the daughter of Otto Carl Rosbach and Ruth Amelia Yarheis Rosbach. When she was 4 years old, her family moved to rural Strawberry Point and eventually settled on a farm north of Monona. Lois attended country school through eighth grade and graduated high school in Monona with the class of 1951. She then attended Luther College and earned her teaching certificate. Lois taught at Jessup Community School, and on December 28, 1956, she was united in marriage to Richard Edward Thedens at St. Paul Lutheran Church in Monona. The couple made their home on the family farm outside of Raleigh, where Dick and Lois raised their family. She continued teaching as a substitute at Independence for many years, and she became involved in the mentorship program. She served as township clerk and election board member for many years. Lois was an active member of the First Presbyterian Church and held many roles within the church. She was part of the Presbytery of East Iowa Peacemaking Committee, which allowed her to travel to the former Soviet Union in 1984 and participate in peacemaking discussions with her counterparts, one of the highlights of her life. She was a certified master gardener, tending her own garden for 67 years, and a wonderful cook. Memorials may be directed to the Raleigh Presbyterian Church or given directly to an organization of the donor's choice reflected in her life. Online condolences may be placed at white-mounthope.com. White Funeral Home Independence is in charge of arrangements. Lori Jones, 60, of Cedar Rapids and formerly of Olwine, died Monday, March 18th at Pillars of Cedar Valley in Waterloo. Memorial service, 5:30 p.m., Saturday, March 23rd, at the Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home in Olwine. Gathering of family and friends, 4 to 6 p.m. on Saturday at the funeral home. Final resting place, Woodlawn Cemetery, Olwine, at a later date. Online obituary at jamesonschmitzfuneralhome.com. James M. Jimmy O'Brien, 62, of Olwine, died Tuesday morning, March 19th, at the Good Samaritan Society in Ottumwa. Funeral service, 10:30 a.m., Friday, March 22nd, at the Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home in Olwine, with Reverend Ray Atwood officiating. Visitation, 4 to 6:30 p.m., Thursday, March 21st, and for 1 hour before the service on Friday at the funeral home. Parish scripture service, 6:30 p.m., Thursday, at the funeral home. Interment, Woodlawn Cemetery, Olwine. In lieu of flowers, memorials may be directed in Jimmy's name to Curtis House Alternative Living, River Hills School, or Good Samaritan Society. Online obituary at jamesonschmitzfuneralhome.com. James Michael O'Brien was born January 2, 1962, at Olwine, the son of Robert and Kathleen Mullaly O'Brien. He attended school at River Hills in Cedar Falls and graduated from Antes Development Center in West Union in 1982. Jimmy worked at Goodwill in Stanley and Olwine. He lived at the Alternative Living Corporation Curtis House in Olwine from 1992 until January of 2024, at which time he moved to the Good Samaritan Society in Ottumwa, Iowa, until his passing. Daniel Robert Tissell, 41, of West Branch, formerly of Coggin, died Sunday, March 17th. Family and friends will gather at Pizza Ranch in Marion on March 23rd at 1:30 p.m. to celebrate Dan's life. Dan had a love of horses, fast cars, and big trucks, but his biggest love was his family. He will always be an inspiration to his family with how he overcame every obstacle thrown at him, no matter how big it was. He continually defied the odds. Stephen Dale Hines, 78, of Clarence, entered eternity on Monday, March 18th. Visitation will be held on Friday, March 22nd from 10 to 11 a.m., followed by a celebration of life service at 11 o'clock, all at Fry Funeral Home in Tipton. Burial will be held at a later date in Rose Hill Cemetery, Mechanicsville. Online condolences may be shared at fryfuneralhome.com. That concludes today's obituaries. Moving to the editorial page, there is one letter to the editor today. It is from Brian Golnick of Iowa City. Headline reads, Althea Cole's Condescension in Column Gets Us Nowhere. Althea Cole's condescending March 17th column about Tara Dutcher's acquittal is unhelpful for furthering debate on important issues such as gender discrimination and policing. Cole doesn't just disagree with Dutcher. Cole is condescending, saying things like, apparently not content to make the case to a jury of the alleged crimes, Dutcher seemed to spend as much time before trial trying to demonstrate that protesters charged were victims. Apparently not content signals sarcasm, not journalism. That the editorialist is personally offended by the issue at stake, transgender activism, is apparent. We see it in the endnote, which tells readers that Cole respectfully declines to use they-them as individual pronouns for reasons of conscience. There's nothing respectful in talking about people in ways they don't want. Framing non-traditional gender identities this way is prima facie uncredible. Moreover, the suggestion that being rude is a matter of conscience trivializes complex issues. This comes up again at the end when Cole describes Dutcher as a self-involved performer spellbound by song and dance. This description patronizes readers and Dutcher, who has a long trajectory as a talented and highly respected musician. The thrust of Cole's editorial is that Dutcher was merely posturing. It's easy to accuse someone of posturing when you are not facing a criminal charge, as Dutcher was. On this level, Cole's editorial denounces in someone else what she herself does, posture. The Gazette ought to be part of a better public dialogue. It's a letter in today's Gazette from Brian Golnick of Iowa City. Here is a guest column by Bob Watson. A Shameful Decision by Iowa DNR. As a former combat Marine and a disabled Vietnam veteran, I was both sadly disappointed and troubled by the news that the Iowa Department of Natural Resources has cut ties to an annual fishing trip for disabled vets, Iowa DNR and Sponsorship of Disabled Vets Fishing Trip, March 1st. After persuading the nonprofit Veterans Casting Away Disabilities Group to move from Minnesota to Iowa's DNR-owned Honey Creek Resort at Lake Rathbun, the DNR now says they are ending their sponsorship and have asked the organizers to remove the Iowa DNR's name and logo from all marketing materials, boat trailers, and other equipment associated with the event. Perhaps Donald Trump's transactional patriotism has filtered down through the Reynolds administration to the DNR. Trump's patriotism is based on value derived from transactions rather than on morals, ethics, or principles. This was clearly shown when he passed on visiting a World War I cemetery in France where Marines were buried, calling them losers and suckers for getting killed in action. On July 18, 2015, Trump appeared at the Family Leadership Summit in Ames. When asked about Arizona Senator John McCain, Trump responded, "He's not a war hero. He's a war hero because he was captured. I like people who weren't captured, okay?" McCain spent 6 years in prison in North Vietnam. In August 1969, my life was saved by a fellow Marine, Jose, when we were up in the Khe San Mountains in Vietnam. A few months later, in January 1970, when we were back down in the rice paddies, Jose was captured by the NVA. Unlike most captured enlisted men, he was not executed, but rather marched up the Ho Chi Minh Trail and was a prisoner for 3 years. According to Trump, Jose would have been a loser and a sucker and not a hero. Iowa and the Reynolds administration are sitting on billions of dollars marked for tax cuts, mostly for the rich. They asked these disabled veterans to come to Iowa where the DNR would help with their fishing outing. Now the DNR is not interested in spending any money on these disabled veterans, leaving them in a lurch. Transactionally, there is nothing for the DNR to gain by continuing its sponsorship of these disabled veterans. Pretty shameful. I can't imagine any veteran voting for Trump or Reynolds. Bob Watson lives in Decorah. Here is a guest column by the Science Iowa Board. Senate vaccine bill threatens Iowans' health. It's risky when lawmakers play doctor, yet that's what Iowa legislators do when they return to Des Moines every January. This session is no different. A long list of bills eschew scientific data in favor of misinformation, prejudice, and political posturing. Science Iowa and its more than 400 members advocate for evidence-based policy. We're concerned that these bills jeopardize public health. Leading the pack, Senate File 2064, which revokes a minor's right to consent to vaccinations for sexually transmitted diseases or infections. A parent or guardian would have to approve instead. The bill's main target is the vaccine that blocks human papillomavirus, the most common sexual infection in the United States. But it would also require a parent's consent for shots preventing two other dangerous sexually spread conditions, hepatitis B and C. HPV can cause genital warts and cancer of the cervix, vulva, vagina, penis, and throat. These diseases can develop years after infection, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The HPV vaccine is only effective, however, if it's administered before infection, so it's recommended for minors as young as 11 or 12. The evidence of its safety is overwhelming, with mostly mild, short-lived reactions. Healthcare providers have administered millions of HPV shots. Yet the Iowa Department of Health and Human Services reports that fewer than two-thirds of Iowa youths receive HPV vaccine, risking the health and lives of many Iowans. And the University of Iowa's Cancer in Iowa report for 2024 found the state is second in the nation for the highest rate of new throat cancers. The Science Iowa Board includes Dan Chibnall, Ruth Henderson, Thomas R. O'Donnell, Lori Neuerberg, Nathan Steimel, and Chris Jones. Science Iowa is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization with more than 400 members and endorses science in the public interest, research for the common good, and evidence-based policy. The group urges lawmakers to listen to experts and not rumor or myth. And that does it for today's reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Wednesday, March 20th, 2024. I'm your reader, Janet Griffith. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.